And I have found the best way to get rid of anybody is to say, well, if you write it for me, I'll publish it. And the amount of people that won't bother you anymore. And unfortunately or fortunately, the person that I said that to came back within 24 hours. It's something about 170 words. It was, and it was, to my mind, it's always known as the urgent post. That was the urgent, and it went from there. And things moved pretty fast after that.
Obviously, this is a site that, well, was being flagged up for you by colleagues and peers and stuff. But, I mean, did you have a chance, before this person gave you this, to actually figure out if there was actually any kind of, you know, in your eyes, substance to these claims? You know, even trusting, you know, the people who were talking to you, was there a kind of... a time at which you go and, let me check this up. I mean, could you, you know?
If I was going back over it again, I'd be a little more cautious. Mm-hmm. But for all that, the people that were talking to me, I trust them implicitly. I've known them in many cases for decades. There were a number of people that I knew were attempting to... Like, it wasn't that everybody was coming to me. I wasn't this kind of, you know, lightning rod for complaining. People were trying to discuss it with the site director. There were representations, I understand, made to the Northern Ireland Environment Agency. Mm-hmm. And none of that, in the eyes of what I was being told, or by the people I was talking to, none of those people were getting any traction. And I will have to say, and I've gone on record before and will again, saying that exposing this via an archaeological blog is not the right way to do it. However, there was nobody else that appeared at that time to be listening. And so, well, I suppose what I should point out, the site we're talking about, it's not just another very ordinary site. This is a remarkably well-preserved chronog. Early medieval man-made island.
Yeah.
Incredible degree of preservation, fantastic site, high status finds, incredible preservation of wood and environmental materials. This was something that, as far as we could see, was being swept under the carpet. Mm-hmm. And at the very least, I thought it deserved further investigation, and I think rather recklessly put my name and reputation on the line, and it was a gamble that paid off. And I have to say, in retrospect, yeah, it was a huge gamble. The first responses we got were from the archaeological establishment, which was largely, there's nothing to see here, everything's going fine. And the further on it went, the more it was clear that things weren't fine. And a number of key meetings took place. And at one of those, there was the then Minister for the Environment, who assessed the situation and took what cannot have been an easy decision, which was that on one side, all the people that were saying this, everything was perfect, were wrong. And that there was a voice, and please don't think that I'm for one moment saying it was just me. Quite quickly, an advocacy group sprung up, very, very loosely affiliated. And it was myself and a number of other people. I kind of became the figurehead of it at some respect.
Yeah.
And that what we were saying was the actual truth. And the minister really took a big gamble on this and said, yeah, this archaeology is really, really important. And he instituted a number of procedural changes that ensured that, well, what we have now is possibly one of the most important excavations of our generation on this island. And yeah, fantastic. The people with the power in this time use that tool for good. And we have a fantastic excavation because of it.
That's a great story. I think that's a really good story, because obviously, you know, in the annals of time, in 100,000 years' time, this will be told in a very, very different way, that the bright, strong archaeologists rose against the tyrannical archaeological institute and managed to trash the
guard. I'm just hoping that in the movie they get George Clooney to play me, you know?
I think he might need some digging up. But the thing is, I think for me, what attracted me to that story in particular was archaeology is usually seen as a very boring, banal, and very non-contentious subject, especially... Well, within archaeology itself, obviously, we all get a bit angry. But, like, to the public, it's something that people don't really think of angry archaeologists. And I think that... Well, I mean, what I mean angry is in a very loving way. I mean in a kind of... Archaeologists are passionate, and often their passion, it manifests itself in a real frustration with the lack of communication tools that they have with the public or the outside world, let's say, you know, outside the dig site. And I think that it's quite interesting that this controversy got such a following so quickly. I don't know, what's your perspective? Do you mean...
Well, I think for me the biggest insight was a piece that Stuart Rathbone wrote. I don't know if you've encountered him. He's a fantastic, real, real excellent thinker in archaeology. And he's written a beautiful piece that he gave for me for my blog about archaeological protest in Ireland. And he takes a number of cases, including the Tara controversy around the M3, the Viking Waterford Woodstown protests, and the Drumclay Cronog, and contrast them and how they were carried out and what they achieved. And it was his insight into it that really struck me, that the Drumclay Cronog advocacy group, basically it was mostly professional archaeologists who treated it as an internal issue. Mm-hmm. We directly went and contacted that politician and that person in power. It mm-hmm. wasn't about being out on the streets waving placards. And perhaps because it had a degree of restraint, a degree of professionalism, dare I say it, about it, that we end up having a much more positive result and doing, I think, less long-term damage to relationships within archaeology because of it.
That's actually a really interesting perspective. Actually, I might make sure the listeners get a link to that at the bottom and go through it themselves. It's just, for me, history in Northern Ireland and archaeology in the past in both Northern Ireland and Ireland are contentious issues just by its very mention. And it's quite interesting to see this response with a very distant past. I mean, there seems to be something definitely quite unifying about the distant past in Ireland compared to, you know, compared to the more contemporary past. I don't know. What's your...
To address that one, I'd actually leave the Drumclay issue to one side, because, yeah, like I said, that was mostly archaeologists talking about one side. But like before I left archaeology, I'd done about 20 years in commercial archaeology, most of that... I'd say about 15 or so in Northern Ireland. And you get some really, really strange reactions to the distant past that are all seen through the prism of, well, I suppose I still think of it as the recent past, but we are talking about back to 1690.
Yeah.
And
yeah, they can't let that go, can they?
No, we can't. I've been on sites. I remember there was one story I got told. I was tangentially involved in excavations out by Rathfryland. And Rathfryland? Somewhere out.
I think so. it's got a Rath in it. It must be in Northern Ireland somewhere. It's
But in that case, one of the locals came along, saw a patch of burning on the ground, and interpreting it through his particular historical lens, he went, I know what that is. King Billy was coming back from the Boyne. One of his horses must have thrown a shoe. And so they were sent for somebody, the blacksmith to, and this is like a total, like some archaeologists going nuts in interpretation. This guy, one little patch of burning, and he had this whole thing about King Billy's horse and a horseshoe. And we said, well, we don't know about that, but there is some prehistoric pottery coming out of it. Totally ignored. No interest in that whatsoever. There were other cases where we had, I think it was two Ringditch cemeteries. Yeah. And one of them, we were standing right beside it. These are classic ring ditches, mm-hmm. shallow circular ditched enclosures with a central burial with pottery. And we have a pretty good idea of where these date to. But this guy, nope. These were obviously men that were injured in the Battle of the Boyne. They died along the way, and this is where they were buried. And no amount of talking ever will get that. The other side of it is, don't get me wrong, mm-hmm. lunacy in terms of archaeological interpretation isn't the preserve of one community.
Oh no!
I remember at one stage talking to somebody about, it was an Iron Age burial, mm-hmm. and that it had a number of blue glass beads. And the guy's immediate interpretation was, well, that must have been a rosary. And this is from about 200 BC. There were no rosaries. But again, no. That level of sanity was lacking. There are certain prisms that people will view everything through.
Oh yeah, I you know what? Having you say that actually just reminds me. I've been out of the country far too long.
This is why you left.
I'll say it now. It is why I left. Because this is something I went to school in Belfast, and I had to walk through different parts of Belfast on the daily. Although I won't say which school I went to, because then I'll be talked as a posh prick. But because I've had
then it'll be a Catholic posh prick or a Protestant posh prick.
Trust me, my school was in BT9, so that'll tell you something. Oh, jeez, I've given away too much information, but I could just say we weren't scum like the Ince dogs downtown. So I'll just say that now. If anybody from Northern Ireland is listening to this, and they're from Inst, we won every single time. That was rugby. I don't know if you're big on your sports, actually. Are you a big rugby fan?
I'm a shirt fat man. I have no interest or ability in
sports. I mean, watching sports, come on.
No. Sort of 90 minutes of people running around. Even that alone tires me.
So obviously, having a large selection of books on archaeology, and you say you're out of archaeology, but I mean, now you sound as if you're pretty immersed in it. So what's been your story over the last little bit then?
Okay. I went to university in the late 80s. I got a university place studying arts and then picked the courses. I found archaeology from pretty much day one. I loved it. I wanted to be an archaeologist forever. And that didn't really work out as well as I thought it would. Come 2008, we had the financial crash, everything went to hell. And after that, there was a lot of pressures, financial, everything. The work we were getting was short, badly paid, poor conditions, everything. And that really took a toll. And there were a number of issues along the way, but basically in 2011, the end of 2011, I couldn't take it anymore. and it was having an effect on me financially, physically, mentally, everything. And I needed to chill out. And so I spent some time at home on the dole, and my wife said, look, you need to think. What are you going to do? And from my perspective, I was, well, fat and 40, and I'd kind of peed off quite a few people in archaeology, and I didn't really see that that was going to be a way forward. So I have ended up retraining in IT, and like a lot of people of my generation, we've drifted out of archaeology with, you know, one degree of speed or another. And I have to say, I am probably the happiest I have been in years. But I still describe myself, you know, it's on my Twitter profile, as a recovering archaeologist. And that I always thought was a funny description until I was at a conference, and there was this bunch of archaeologists that were sharing the conference hotel with Alcoholics Anonymous. And it didn't quite seem so funny then. But there is a bit of similarity in there, well, at least for me. Archaeology is a drug, and it has, for the largest part of my adult life, it has defined who I am, what I do. And I said, I'm really happy in IT, but there's never the same sort of cachet of going to a party. I said, oh, what do you do? I'm in IT versus I'm an archaeologist. You know, one, you know, I'm happily married, have been for years. It's not like I'm out there trying to pull the ladies. But, you know, you meet people and you see the light go out in their eyes when you say IT. It's
yeah. It's so amazing.
It has that cachet, yeah. And it has a draw on me. It's in my blood. And I started the blog just over 4 years ago now. Before I left archaeology, thinking the company I was with may or may not go under. And if it did, I needed to have, a higher public profile. And when the CVs went in for, you know, the next job, yeah, I wanted them to go, hey, I know who he is. Let's give him a job.
Yeah.
And that's where it started, just to get my name out there, get a bit better known. And that was its intention. What it has actually morphed into is a way for me to remain connected to the type of archaeology I love, which is, you know, being passionate about, whether it's, you know, giving out about the Chronog, or you know, I'm currently writing one on the financial health of the Republic of Ireland's archaeological sector from 2001 to 2014. Or to just go, look, I've taken some photographs of a really cool place and I would like to share these with you. And all those things, I still remain incredibly passionate about it. And blogging is one way that I do that. And it's a fantastic way for me. It's allowed me to morph off into being an IT guy during the day while still maintaining this really important part of my personality. It's a crutch. It's no more, no less.
You know, it's amazing you saying this, because I've been saying from episode one that archaeologists, you're once an archaeologist, always an archaeologist, and there's no one who's an archaeologist who takes their hat off at the end of the day and thinks, no more archaeology for me, not going to think about it, nothing. I'm going to void my mind.
I've met one person like that.
No. No, they're not a real archaeologist.
That's exactly my point. He once said to me, I do archaeology because it's easy.
What?
And I smack him.
Good, you should have given him a freaking belt around the face. What is he talking about? Oh my word. Oh, jeez.
You know, if you think archaeology is an easy thing, you're not doing it right.
Ooh, that makes me blood boil. Sorry. Oh dear. Because the funny thing is, obviously, I'm coming more from a, well, I came to archaeology from a science background, which meant that which funnily enough has completely been balanced off by my absolute love of post-processionalism to the extreme. Like, I'm saying, like, Shanks and Tilly and, like, Hodder are, like, my three idols when it comes to archaeological theory. I love this kind of, like, way of destabilizing the authority of the past, in a sense, to destabilize people who use that authority for bad intentions. I mean, what my problem is that a lot of the time, the reason why things get picked up and that they have a certain pastness, like an aura, is because there's an inherent or an assumed authority by a society in the past because of its pastness. And like, I want to kind of see if we can subvert a little bit of that authority to better put the means of production of the past in the hands of many different people. I'm a little tiny, tiny, tinsy bit Marxist in that sense. And that's scary for some people. And I like to be scary.
On Friday last, I was invited by... who was it? Nick Maxwell of Archaeology Ireland. Down to be part of a History of Ireland hedge school in Rathmichael in South County Dublin. And I was asked a question about archaeological theory. And I'm afraid to say I've struggled with theory all my life, in that I came, you know, I went to study in Galway, which wasn't the cutting edge of archaeology then that it is now.
I don't think it's the cutting edge of anything
now. Well,
I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
Students, but no, seriously, it's a fantastic department now. But back when I was there, it was kind of a bit of archaeology with quite a lot of art history. And there were no, well, there was one research excavation that was carried out by the department that you had to be invited to. There was certainly no introduction to anything like theory. Archaeology was just what you did. And I remember being at a lecture given by Professor Charles Orser, an American archaeologist, and he was basically kind of doing archaeological theory 101, and held up a photograph and went, "What is this?" Asked the head of the department, he went, "Well, it's a plate." And was then flummoxed with the question of, "But how do you know it's a plate?" And a lot of the students kind of were on the side of the prof, because we'd all been rather heavily inculcated against, you know, these nasty theorists. And I remember once finding a book by Shanks and Tilly in the library, which had a very, very special sound of creak as you opened it, because nobody ever had before. I'm not daft enough to think that theory doesn't imbue absolutely everything I do. However, my problem is that I'm not sufficiently aware of my own biases to actually list them out and categorize them and understand properly where I'm coming from. But I am reliably informed that, yeah, my work is full of theory. Everybody's is.
No, I know. And this is a really funny thing for me, is because actually I find myself on the extreme end, even among the three BSCs and the 20 MAs. I find myself quite extreme in theory as well, because, like, to me, it's about subverting the, you know, the constant kind of requirements of archaeology on, oh, well, you know, that's nice and all, but let's just get down to the digging, let's just get down to the analysis. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. just wait a minute. What about the theory of, you know, the scientific method is something that I hold very close to my heart. It's a great tool, but it's a tool, you know, nonetheless, and it fits in with everything else. I did trace mercury analysis as part of my dissertation work. It was to establish a link between mercury levels and dietary sources. So so I did a lot of very high-tech, very specialist analysis, but I realized very quickly that my methodology in that was very limited, you know, in the whole scheme of things. I wasn't really doing anything new, and that was kind of upsetting, but you know, you got to do your undergrad dissertation, right?
Yeah, you got to get through that hurdle first before you can go on to do something actually interesting.
I know, exactly. Not to say it wasn't interesting, but it's not what I'm very interested in. I think I'm kind of on the side of public archaeology. I think that's getting closer and closer to That's like the least important job in archaeology, eh? I'm joking. It's funny because you were mentioning earlier that the archaeology books you like have a lot of carbon dates in them. And of course, the most misunderstood thing in the entire world is radiocarbon dating. I was at a wedding last weekend and somebody heard I was an archaeologist and they were like, "So, how do you describe to me how carbon dating works?" Okay, let's try this. Let's not just brush it off. Let's try this. Okay, right. Carbon dating obviously has carbon in it. There are three flavors of carbon, right? There's the normal flavor, that's carbon 12. There's an exciting radioactive flavor, carbon 13, but we'll not deal with that right now. And then finally, we got the most exciting flavor, it's carbon 14. But it's really, really rare, really difficult to make. It only gets made up in the atmosphere. So, what happens is, everything picks up both vanilla, carbon 12, and the exciting carbon 14. And the ratio of these two things give us an idea of how old something is. Now, it's not that simple. There's a few little things to... you have to measure it against a special graph because carbon goes up and down in history. And yeah, when you measure those ratios, the smaller the carbon 14 level, the older it is. I should have got that right. Was that all right?
That's pretty good. Now, you see, I listened to that, and the first thing that's going through my head was I was invited to give a talk a couple of years ago now about radiocarbon dating because I've got this reputation as actually knowing something about it. And I tried to dissuade them from asking me and to actually get them to disinvite me on the basis that what I felt they really needed was somebody with a physics background, because I think it was Rutherford, at least it's attributed to Rutherford, the physicist, that there's two types of science. There's physics and everything else is stamp collecting. And I'm very much of the stamp collecting end of it. Like my archaeology is from an arts background, and I got it into my head, I think it must be about 2006, so well, heading on for a decade ago, that I was in the process of writing up a site, and it was one of the ubiquitous Irish burnt mounds or Fallacht na Fia. Mm-hmm. And how do you describe these, or how do you go about comparing and contrasting them? Oh, it was a slightly off circular pit. Well, do we find other ones? And of course, when you go by morphology, mm-hmm. you get, you know, things that could be thousands of years apart, certainly hundreds. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be nice if we had, you know, I've got a couple of radiocarbon dates from this site. Wouldn't it be nice to say, well, okay, it doesn't quite look like this, but you know what? This one's actually contemporary.
Yeah.
And it struck me that what I also knew that in the coming months that I would have another burnt mound site to write up of a slightly different date. But wouldn't it be good to be able to do that as well? So this resource doesn't exist. Well, I've been buying books since I started in archaeology. Mm-hmm. I have an entire room of my house converted to being a library with three walls covered in shelves. And, well, that's where my baseline data has to come from. And I started with one volume. And like everybody's favorite, I put it into an Excel spreadsheet. And the amount of people that call it a database, and it really rankles me. I think it's lovely that people even know that I do this, but it's not a database. It's just a list. But you can do an awful lot of things with a list. And you can find interesting things. And I've been trying to develop an idea of creating radiocarbon landscapes. Mm-hmm. So if you find a burial, it's all very easy to find other burials, even other burials of the same mm-hmm. day. But what I'm trying to do is write narratives that go, you've got a burial of 1000 BC in Galway. Well, what was happening? Well, okay, let's look across this island. What other burials were going on around that time? What are their similarities? What are their dissimilarities? But also, you know, burials aren't the extent of life. They're domestic structures, ritual structures, weird stray finds that just happen to be dated, and normal, shall we say, research pathways won't bring you to this data or this data to you. It's only when you go, well, here's my core date, give me 30 radiocarbon years on each side of that, what do we find? And it does throw up some interesting things. Admittedly, there's not many people that are vastly interested in it, and nobody's breaking down my door to give me money to do it. Yeah. But I think it's an interesting thing to do.
No, that's amazing. And Radiocarbon Landscape is an amazing post-metal album name. Like, I'm going to take that. That is fantastic. That is, oh, up there. Radiocarbon Landscape. I love it. I love it. And obviously, this is...
Sorry, I'm still laughing at the idea that there's post-metal.
Yeah, post-metal, like Isis, the band, not the group, Neurosis.
I heard the band from Palmyra. Sorry, no, edit that, stop.
There's also Red Sparrow. There's certain music genres that I really quite like, so trust me, post-metal is the most normal of music genres that I know.
I'm afraid I'm sort of classic rock, Dylan, Stones, Grateful Dead.
Oh dear, oh dear.
I know, I'm sorry, there's no help.
Child of your time, a child of your time.
I'm a child of my parents' time.
Child in Time, released by Deep Purple, I think 1976. Ah, see?
But when I was growing up, everybody else's parents were worried about, like, you know, sort of the devilish pop music they were listening to. My parents were going, he's listening to an awful lot of Dylan. That's not normal.
Do you know, I was raised, right, on the Rocky Horror Picture Show soundtrack and a German punk band called Die Toten Hosen. Because my mother's German and I'm half German. Obviously the better half of me is Northern Irish. But honestly, I've had a weird music upbringing as well. I started getting back into, like, I was starting to listen to really, really well produced stuff from the 70s, actually. You know, like, you know, you know when music's really well put together, like the mixing's really done really well. I love that, and that's why I really appreciate music, and that's why there's actually a lot of the bands you've mentioned. Some of their remastered stuff is actually really, really good. Just because I remember listening to, who was it? It was Led Zeppelin. I can't remember which album it was. It was absolutely wonderful. Really nice to listen to. And are you a fan of Pink Floyd?
Oh, that's okay. I thought you said, are you a fan of Pink? And I thought, no.
No, Pink Floyd.
Yes, big Pink Floyd fan. Really wished I had been able to see him live in their heyday.
Yeah.
But... like, you know, you grew up around Belfast. I presume you've been up to Belfast Zoo?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, you know the Floral Hall, this beautiful Art Deco gem that's falling apart?
I love Art Deco, yes, of course I know that.
But you know the building I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
It's eyesore at the beginning of the zoo. Floyd played there in 67, and it's just one of these things. I liked it as a building anyway, but knowing that it was kind of like a hallowed ground, just it's beauty in my... Stop laughing!
I love Art Deco. It's an underappreciated building, like, for... I love it because it's just so... Like, I just love the structure to it, the big, thick lines. Like, I when it comes to buildings, I like things that stand out, you know, especially, actually, I've also got a soft spot for Soviet building structures, the kind of blocky, almost brutalist kind of, I love brutalism because it upsets people. I think it's probably the other...
Well, actually, I adore Art Deco buildings. But it's like a lot of modern art. I can appreciate it, but I don't necessarily, you know, either want the art hanging on my walls or want to live in one of those buildings. I grew up in a house that had a partially flat roof, and that is kind of one of the trademarks or potential trademarks of deck. And my parents had nothing but problems with it. I lived in a house when I first came to Belfast that had a flat roof, and it was horrible. It wasn't a deco house. It was just like a little terraced house with a flat extension. And these things, they can put you off, you know?
Well, I think I just like things that discomfort other people. That's probably why I have an addiction to death metal.
Are we not so far past the time that the deco made people uncomfortable?
I don't know, because I think...
Has it not become accepted?
Well, I think generally people have your opinion on it. Oh, it's all right, but I wouldn't live in it. No, I think Art Deco is probably still admired from a distance. Glasgow is actually a lovely city architecturally, if you've ever been.
I've only been through Glasgow once, and I was actually on a bus to Edinburgh, and I fell asleep. I woke up, and the first thing I saw was we were crossing over the river, and I saw the Armadillo building.
Oh, yeah.
And just in this moment of being half awake, suddenly took fright going, how long have I been on the bus? That's Sydney Opera House.
Oh, no. Oh, the moments.
Yes.
But
you know, you're half awake. Uh-huh. The sanity isn't completely enveloped around you just yet. But yeah, that's unfortunately my only encounter with Glasgow so far.
It's just funny because Aberdeen is grey, and I mean grey. Like, all the buildings are grey. I live in a grey house, which is on a grey street, which is surrounded by other grey buildings because it's all made of granite. Everything is grey.
I grew up in Galway City. There were a lot of my university years in Galway City, and everything is limestone. It's all grey as well. So I know what you're talking about.
But you see, Belfast has these lovely red brick buildings and structures, and has lots of different things in it. Which, I mean, I do also feel the architecture some places is a little bit it's a little bit dated. Let's say.
I don't know. I think. And I've said this before to friends who have taken a while to get the idea, but Belfast city centre architecturally is amazing so long as you add a single-decker bus.
Oh, right, yeah.
And what I mean by this is stand on the other side of the road, have the ground floor view blocked by a bus, and look at everything above. And there are some beautiful buildings that have been wrecked for shop front.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're the same ugly, ubiquitous, homogenous, you know, I've nothing against Boots, you know, but they're everywhere. I've nothing against, you know, Burger King, McDonald's, but they're everywhere. And I don't mind them being in purpose-built little, you know, shacks, you know, out in somewhere that isn't an architectural gem. But when you've got one in the center of Belfast, in a building that should be prized as a gem, then that's not right. So put a bus in front of it, look at what's above it. You know,
That's perfect.
It's got a lot.
Right, everybody going to Belfast, remember to bring a bus in your pocket, and then you can just, like, inflate it and put it out in front.
Even a small piece of art that you just hold it up.
Oh, my... Could you imagine, like, all these people, like, going to Belfast, like, holding this up? Actually, you know, do it sneakily. Just hold up your phone. There we go.
Yeah. You know, everybody will think you're so self-involved. You're taking a selfie.
Oh dear. You do know that word beans. You're not that old, eh? Selfie.
Pardon?
Selfie.
Oh,
what's
yes,
that?
Yes, yes. Self portrait. Yes.
Oh, yeah. So,
excuse me, I've just dropped my monocle.
Oh dear. It's one of those things that, like, archaeology is obviously always moving at quite a rapid rate. I mean, there's been a lot of stuff recently. I've interviewed twice on my show Andrew Reinhard, the Archaeogamer, who runs his own blog called Archaeogaming and is actually starting to do research in that as well. And there's a lot of other people I know who uses 3D modeling, and I've talked to them and everything. I mean, obviously you've got a bit of knowledge in IT. I mean, do you think IT will ever intersect with archaeology, just ever so slightly for you? I mean, past making lists.
Well, yes. The job I was originally trained as a programmer, as a developer, and it turns out I wasn't as good at that as I'd hoped. By which I mean I kind of sucked at it, and my life was pretty miserable for a while. But I'm with a really big company, and they said, "Look, you didn't work in that role. That's nobody's fault. Let's find you something else." So they put me on to doing process audits, which in some respects is not all that different from what I used to do on site, of checking people's contact sheets and making sure everything was in the right order and, you know, that sort of stuff. But the big businesses like metrics and they like graphs. And I found that the skills that I had with drawing bar charts in Excel weren't as universal in the world of IT as I thought they were. And so I found, I can shake your head at that. Well, when I was leaving my development team, you know, I worked with some really, really skilled developers. Mm-hmm. And they were saying to me, look, man, best of luck in the audit team, but it's not a role that would work out for me. I couldn't do it. And I met my team manager and he said, look, you know, what skills do you have here that would be useful to us? How are you with, you know, written English, with Excel, with PowerPoint? And when, you know, why not? Of course I know these things. And they're not as universally available as skills as I thought they were. However, you know, everybody's looking for the best way and the most interactive way to bring the metrics. You know, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And every manager wants their metrics. And I've been given access to a rather fantastic tool called Tableau. So I've been learning how to do this in my workplace. But I come home at night and I'm kind of subverting it by taking this tool that is essentially meant for your profit and loss, mm-hmm. your sales, and all those important business things. And the first project I did was to look at the spread of early printing presses in Western Europe. And all you need was, you know, a little bit of data, and it can graph it. You can turn out interesting charts that you can then, as the consumer of them rather than the developer, you can go in and you can play around with these and you can get the insights you want. So I've been doing stuff like that, more historical-based than archaeological. Mm-hmm. But what I was talking to you earlier about, that I'm looking at some financial data relating to Irish archaeological consultancies, yes. That I'm using Tableau to display and get the information together so that you can I can write my narrative about it, but also make this available to other people, mm-hmm. so that they can go, well, I only want to see between these 2 years and for this set of companies.
Yeah.
And I don't want to know about their, you know, their liabilities. I just want to see their cash in the bank. So I think, there's interesting things out there that you can take tools from the IT world that are very business tools and, well, like I said, you know, slightly subvert them for archaeological ends.
That's really cool. But obviously there's always a but wait a minute, you know, this can, you know, there's always problems, you know, this is where your theory comes in. But what I'm saying, what I'd like to say is that it's really, really cool to see one thing that works in one area being put into another. I mean, I've heard people describe archaeology as the magpie subject because it sees the shiny objects and other things and says, oh, I like that. Would you agree with that?
I've never used the term magpie. Scavenger is what I've called archaeology. There is nothing, absolutely nothing, used in archaeology that we've really invented for ourselves. And, you know, from being out on site, you know, nobody has ever went, here is an archaeological trowel invented by archaeologists for archaeology. Mm. Here is the WHS 4-inch pointed trowel. The one thing that typifies what people's impressions of archaeology are all about. It's not ours. We bought it. We've nicked it.
Well, it depends on who you talk to.
Wheelbarrows, the idea of pro forma, and the technologies, even radiocarbon dating wasn't designed with archaeology in mind. I'm not 100% sure about dendrochronology. I think that might have come from archaeology.
Wait,
but I'm open to correct.
One thing.
But it is one thing. But all these really cool developments, like there's so many people out there that are using commercially available bits and pieces from. I've got a friend who's doing really incredible work, just using Google Earth to find new sites in Ireland. Obviously, there's been a high-profile case with potential sites being identified in Egypt, and there are all these things. I think, gaming archaeology. There's a lot. Anything you can put your mind to, you can take that and you can use it. And archaeology, I think that's one of its strengths. It's kind of like the English language. It kind of goes, oh, that's an interesting foreign word. We'll be having you.
Yeah.
And drags it in kicking and screaming. I think archaeology should never be ashamed of the fact that, we scavenge from other disciplines. In terms of theory, there's very little, in my experience, archaeological theory that is generated within archaeology itself. As a lot of us will, here's something we took from sociology, here's something from geography, and, more power to us for being that adaptable.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, unfortunately, see it as a weakness, especially outsiders to archaeology, by which I mean people who haven't spent enough time around archaeologists, of course. But I think it is one of these things that, like, people say, well, what can archaeology do for everybody? What can archaeology bring us if it doesn't create anything out of itself? But yet, these novel ways are fantastic, because these are ways that we can then reciprocally use in other ways. I mean, I've always thought to myself, well, what about the archaeology of, I don't know, like thinking archaeologically about things that are not necessarily archaeological. Like, I posed to somebody, what about the archaeology of brushing teeth? Because ultimately, brushing teeth doesn't leave a trace on the workspace that you use, but it does leave a trace, or a lack of a trace, on your own teeth. It's something very physical that builds up over time, over years. And I mean, think about it like this. In the past, we didn't really have the same level of toothbrushing as we do now. And obviously, when we look at teeth in the past, we can use them to, like, age, and etc., etc. I mean, but the problem is, what if you tried to age someone by their regularly brushed teeth now? You know? What are the... like, in what other subject would that ever come up as an idea, like, as a thought?
Yeah, I think one of, I suppose if we just kind of throw this back slightly to me, when I was pottering around in this office back in late 2011, early 2012, going, what skills do I have? What have I got from archaeology that I can actually use anywhere else? And I'll be honest, I went through quite a depressing time going, not a hell of a lot, right? And I eventually got rid of them, but I did keep them around for years, even though they were like a cancerous sore. The stack of rejection letters for entry-level positions where I didn't meet the grade, very, very, nothing wrong with the jobs. I needed a job. I was going for anything, but nobody wanted me because none of my skills mattered. But I think it's that archaeological approach to thinking, and it's not exclusive to archaeology, but it's just asking weird questions, thinking rigorously about data. I think there are things that pay off there. And so for me, it's worked out, and I think it's time we started tracking down where people who've been in archaeology for a while and they've left the profession, where they've gotten to, and how the archaeological skills they've built up, how those have helped them or indeed hindered them. I don't know. I think it's something that's certainly worth a thought.
Yeah, and actually that's one of the things that professional bodies in archaeology in UK and Ireland are something very focused on, because I've been told time and time again that there was a great exodus of archaeologists, and it's left a bit of a vacuum at the moment because development has started up again. No, I mean, like, there are people who have left, and not everybody's leaving has been voluntary. You know, a lot of the time they've been forced out, like yourself, forced out because of changes in financial things. But I think you've got a good idea there about checking up on people. I mean, not checking up on people, but seeing how these, because this is.
Outreach. Yeah. It's outreach.
This plays into like the value of archaeology as a degree, the value of archaeology in general in the public, which is something that I think is very underplayed, you know. I think that's one of things that people say to me, as I'm just digging in the dirt. I'm like, I don't have enough words to explain why it's not digging in the dirt. I can't say it. But I think for me... as the anarchaeologist, it's always very important to make outrageous statements, because then people are like, well, what's he talking about? He's just saying outrageous statements, or is there something behind this? Like, I like to say anthropology is archaeology, or what else do I like saying to people?
This is the level of crazy. You could be a Republican candidate for president.
Archaeology is everything, or it is nothing.
Well, I used to enjoy winding up a doctor friend of mine and saying, look, you just, you know, cure people. Mm-hmm. I'm an archaeologist. I bring people back from the dead. And it's...
Love it. That's beautiful.
Well, in some ways we do, you know. Yeah. If I had a limb hanging off, I know who I'd want. Yeah. But, you know, there is a... an unfortunate degree of worthiness that is associated with archaeology and otherworldliness that, well, you mustn't be quite all there if you're prepared to be that dirty, filthy, poorly paid and generally looked down upon. Mm. You know, there are these ideas in the Irish mythologies of these people that are crazy, they're touched by the hand of God, and they're somehow outside of society and you don't want them in your house, but they're very, very important people that should be respected. And archaeology and archaeologists are a little like that. You know, you see, you know, Time Team is a remarkably respected, or was a remarkably respected TV show, even though I despised it.
You and me both, brother. You and me both.
It was banned in my house. My wife said I wasn't allowed to watch it anymore. I just screamed obscenities at the TV too much. But the amount of people you'd meet that non-archaeologists who loved the show and thought really highly of it, but at the same time were kind of glad that they didn't make those career choices that they ended up in a career in archaeology, because they like, you know, foreign travel, regular meals, you know, stuff like that.
No,
so yeah, archaeology does have a strange place in terms of value.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think one of the solidifying moments for me was realizing that all archaeologists, young or old, of any gender, love bad jokes. I don't know if this is a common thing over there, but I have yet to meet an archaeologist who doesn't like a good joke or a good pun, and is like, who's ready to make them as well, as lovingly receive these wonderful jokes. I have heard so many. Like, for example, archaeologists will date anything.
Archaeologists do it in holes in the ground.
Oh, no. Archaeology, a life in ruins.
That's the best you got for me?
Oh God! Bring it on! Bring it on!
For God!
But
archaeologists, we work by trial and error.
Oh no! Okay, you win. You win. Oh, that is, I've not heard that one before. That is amazing.
See,
I knew it.
Well, the thing is, in my family, my dad was a purveyor of terrible jokes. But then again, while he ended up as a professional accountant, when he was a kid, he worked, his school's Latin master marched a bunch of them off into a Suffolk orchard, which sounds like the beginning of a really terrible story. But in fact, they were going to excavate a Roman villa. And when I was a kid, the photographs that my dad took of the excavation were one of the things that inspired me. And I just thought, well, kind of the bad jokes thing or something that I got from my dad. But I think possibly genetic disposition, predisposition, bolstered by a career in archaeology.
Well, I think it just ties into the whole otherworldly thing. I think it's something you have to have. You have to have a good sense of humor to hang around the dead so often. I definitely have to have a t-shirt that says, I dig dead people. I'll take that one from Sixth Sense.
My wife once got me a t-shirt with a fake email address on it that was robert@buriededthings.com.
Oh, that's quite, I like that.
One of my favorite t-shirts at the moment is by a company called Last Exit to Nowhere. They do one that says Belloc. You know Belloc?
Yes, I do. Okay. Where did you get these from?
Well, like I said, there's this wonderful place. It is Last Exit to Nowhere. They do fantastic shirts. And there's another one that they've... what do you call the guy from Highlander?
No!
Yeah, it's so-and-so's antiques.
Oh, dear.
And it's got a picture of a sword across it. It's brilliant.
Oh, wow. Bad, like, honestly, novelty t-shirts, bad puns. I mean, this is archaeology 101, guys.
I'm trying to think what t-shirt I've got.
Oh, no. He's going Superman on me right now.
No, it's one from the British Museum.
Oh, that imperialist establishment, which I don't really like.
Yes!
Oh, geez. Do you know, it's my goal one day to be banned from the British Museum for being anti-British Museum. One day. I'll get there.
The best I've got so far is I got once kicked out of River Island, the clothes shop.
What? No!
I asked too loudly, apparently standing right beside the general manager. So, other than hookers, who shops here?
Oh.
So I was asked to leave.
Oh, you rebel, you! Oh, dear. So if people want to find your wonderful blog, how would they go about finding it?
Oh, Google Robert M. Chapel Archaeologist. That's and pretty much all the lies and all the rumors and supposition, they're all true. So I'm there on the internet. Mm-hmm. And just writing because I enjoy it. Yeah. And love, like I said, they're on the 22nd, so like just a few days ago, my blog hit 4 years of age. Mm-hmm. And it's got heading for 290,000 reads.
Mm-hmm.
And as I always say, it's not the Huffington Post, but it's...
It's close. It's just a little bit.
I don't think so. But it's... There are people out there that read it. They seem to like it. At the end of the day, I write this for myself. And so long as I'm happy writing and there's anybody out there that's interested in reading, I'll keep on going.
Awesome.
So there you are.
And we can find you on Twitter as well. Do you remember your handle?
Yes. @RMChapel. That's CHAPPLE. So it's as simple as that.
You use Twitter a lot? You big Twitterian? Twitterian? I'm not sure of the term.
Twat?
Yes.
In cold words. I use Twitter quite a bit, but mostly because I have got accidentally hooked up to my Facebook account. I love Facebook. I absolutely adore it.
You are behind the times.
Next thing you're going to be telling me, like, live journal has had its day.
Okay, I'll just let you. No, live journal. The wave of the internet. Web 2.0. What's that? It's on the horizon, right?
It'll be there one day. No, I'm a desperately antisocial person. I'm terrible at keeping up relationships, you know, professional. Even my own family used to hear from me for ages and ages. And then one day I found social media and went, this is cool. And have taken to it in an entirely inappropriate way. Which is why I spend time hiding away in my office, away from, you know, the rest of my family that I should actually be interacting with. But, you know, it's what I do.
Instead, you interact with strangers on the internet. Let's face it, I'm a stranger on the internet. You're interacting with me. Ah, done. Bingo.
It's not like slot roulette or something.
No, that's chat roulette. But anyway, I'll leave you that. Anyway, we're going to wrap up the show. Thank you very, very much for...
Some of us are going to hell in every religion. That's how.
Oh, don't worry. I'm already there. I've already signed that sheet. Anyway, thank you very much for coming on the show and having a wee chat with me and just talking, you know? That's what I appreciate.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to have been asked. It's...
Trust me, it's no big thing.
I have to say, every time I get an invite like this, my first reaction is to say, no, I don't want to do it. And I'm trying to be, well, pretend to be a better human as I get older and try to embrace some of these challenges. And yeah, talking to strangers is not easy for me. And I do have a lot of difficulty with it, but I made the decision that, yeah, I'm going to do this. I've never done something like this before. So, yeah, thank you for giving me the opportunity to push a break.
Wow, you fooled me, man. You fooled me. Like, you have problems talking to me.
Take a while to get warmed up.
You better listen to this. You better listen to this back. And you just listen to the first bit and see just that you came out the door rolling. Like, seriously, I don't believe you when you say you have a problem talking to people. I don't believe you. Don't believe you.
The first. Now you're making me all self-conscious. You know, mm-hmm. I'll turn into Rain Man by the time it's over.
Oh,
gotta see water.
Oh dear. But don't you worry. Don't you worry. This will not be used against you, but it will be up on the internet
yeah.
For all.
And of course, yeah, that's the other side of it, making all this public. But yeah, you know, the serious part of this is,
of course,
thank you very much for asking me. I know this started as a conversation a long, long time ago, and you know, so much kind of got thrown up in between, but I'm really glad we've had the opportunity to do this. And if for nothing else, I learned how to install Skype on my machine.
Oh, don't worry, we're managing the Anarchaeologist podcast to teach old dogs new tricks. And if you want to hear more from the Anarchaeologist podcast, remember you can catch us on iTunes. We'll be shortly migrating to the Archaeology Podcast Network full time, so my website will just be a blog, me rambling about absolutely useless things. If you're interested in any of the other shows, there's Archaeological Fantasies, which is about pseudoscience, pseudo-archaeology, and the rest of it, done by our famous, kind of famous author, Ken Fader, with host Sarah, leading you through many conversations and interesting pieces about what people say about weird archaeology. In the meantime, if you were at EAA Glasgow, it's going to be the future. If you were at EAA Glasgow, it was amazing to come see, meet you and see so many faces. And we'll definitely have some of the conversations that we recorded there up soon. So keep listening, keep digging, and we'll see you out in the field.
The The CRM Archaeology Podcast brings together a panel of cultural resource management professionals to discuss the issues that really matter to the profession. Find out about networking strategies, job hunting, graduate programs, and much more. We'll often feature interviews with college professors, CRM business owners, and experts as well. Check out the show on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/CRM Arc Podcast. Let's get back to the show.